There was a monastery which had fallen upon hard times. Once a very great order, it suffered a loss of spirit, so that there were only 5 monks left, all over the age of 70. Clearly, it was a dying order. In the deep woods surrounding the monastery, there was an old shack to which a rabbi from a nearby town occasionally used to come for hermitage. Through their many years of prayer and contemplation, the old monks had become a bit psychic, so they could always sense when the rabbi was in his hermitage. "The rabbi's in the woods, the rabbi's in the woods again," they would whisper to each other. Agonizing over the imminent death of his beloved monastery, it occurred to the abbot at one such time to visit the rabbi and ask if by some chance he could offer any advice that might save the dying order. The rabbi welcomed the abbot at his shack, but when the abbot explained the purpose of his visit, the rabbi could only commiserate with him. "I know how it is," he exclaimed. "The spirit has gone out of the people. It is the same in my town. Almost no one comes to the synagogue anymore." So the old abbot and the old rabbi wept together. Then they read parts of the Torah and quietly spoke of deep things. The time came when the abbot had to leave. "It has been a wonderful thing that we should meet after all these years," the abbot said. "But I have still failed in my purpose for coming here. Is there nothing you can tell me? No piece of advice you can give me that would help me save my dying order?" "No, I am sorry," the rabbi responded. "I have no advice. The only thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you." When the abbot returned, his fellow monks crowded around him. "Well, what did the rabbi say?" "He couldn't help," the abbot answered. "We just wept and read the Torah together. The only thing he did say, just as I was leaving, it was something cryptic, was that the Messiah is one of us." In the days and weeks and months that followed, the old monks pondered this and wondered whether there was any possible significance to the rabbi's parting words, "The Messiah is one of us." Could he possibly have meant one of us monks here at the monastery? If that's the case, which one? Do you suppose he meant the abbot? Yes, if he meant anyone, he probably meant Father Abbot. He's been our leader for more than a generation. But then he might have meant Brother Thomas. Certainly Brother Thomas is a holy man. Everyone knows that Thomas is a man of light. Certainly he couldn't have meant Brother Elred. Elred gets crotchety. But come to think of it, Elred is virtually always right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Brother Elred. But surely not Brother Philip. He's so passive. But then Philip is always there when you need him. He just mysteriously appears at your side. Maybe Philip is the Messiah. Of course, the rabbi didn't mean me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet supposing he did, suppose I am the Messiah. Oh God, not me. I couldn't be that much for you, could I? As they contemplated in this manner, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect. On the off chance that one among them might be the Messiah, and on the off chance that each monk himself might be the Messiah, they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Because the forest in which it was located was so beautiful, it so happened that people still occasionally came to visit the monastery, to picnic on its lawn, to wander along some of its paths, even now and then to go into the chapel to meditate. As they did, they sensed this aura of extraordinary respect that now began to surround the 5 old monks and seemed to permeate the atmosphere of the place. There was something compelling about it. Hardly knowing why, they began to come back to the monastery more frequently, to picnic, to play, to pray. they began to bring their friends. Then it happened that some of the younger men who came started to talk more and more with the old monks. After a while, one asked if he could join them. Then another, and another. So within a few years, the monastery had once again become a thriving order, and, thanks to the rabbi's gift, a vibrant center of light and spirituality in the realm.
Their circles. Everything begins on the verge of awareness. The dawn is not, and then it is. Sleep is, and then it is not. In between is the awakening. The passage of thin light between breaks open the day. The passage of thin sound between flows into the day, and too soon the numbing rumble of traffic swells and the day glares. May we all let the soft haze hang again across the row of morning. Wait upon the narrow moment, the first awareness of being in between. Let us live days and seasons on the thin edge of dawn, in praise of every single thing begins now. I want to welcome Cindy again, and she's going to come up and share just a little bit with you about her role as transitions coach during the search process.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you, Tricia. It's great to be here. I was here just about exactly 2 years ago, sitting over on that side, while the Reverend Linda Barnes, our search committee candidate, spoke to all of you, and seven of us took careful notes very quietly. And she has been our minister now for a year and a half, and we're delighted. It was a wonderful search, and it worked out really well. I was chair of that search committee. Since then, I've become the transitional coach for the New England region, which means I help other search committees, which is why I'm here this morning. What I wanted to mention to you, it reminded me when I saw the rabbi's gift, is a year before that, when I found out about search committees in our own congregation in Plymouth, New Hampshire, the Star King UU Fellowship, and how the congregation chose the members of the search committee by deciding themselves who they most trusted to be on this committee. Because once the committee of seven people is formed, that's the group that's going to listen to candidates and decide who would be the best minister for your congregation. So those seven people hold within them the trust of the congregation, the understanding of the congregation, to be able to say yes to this person, no to this person, and now we've got the person that we really think will work best with us. So that's kind of a heavy responsibility. So I was 3 years ago, I was called on the phone and said, your name has come up as someone that people would like to have on the search committee. And I said, who, me? Not me. I couldn't be that person. I'm not sure I want to carry that responsibility, because what if people don't like the choice? And I was told, you'll be one of seven. These are all seven people that have come from the congregation with different needs and different understandings of who the congregation is, and you'll work through this together with a coach. It wasn't me, but with a coach. And you'll find it to be one of the most exciting years of your life, which I have to say really was. And a lot of it was learning more and more about the folks we were working with, each other, and becoming the group we needed to be to then go to places like this, listen to candidates, and together sift out who would be the best person for us. So my message today is, if any of you get that phone call and you think, oh no, I couldn't, remember, that's what I said too. Here I am. Also, be thinking about who you might recommend in your congregation, because you'll be asked to come forth with names of people that you would like to see on the search committee. So I will be doing a question-answer time after the potluck to talk a lot more about the search committee and the steps and to answer questions. Please join if you can, and I look forward to talking more with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Cindy, and I am delighted to be able to work in tandem with Cindy. The two of us will be working together, and I am just thrilled with that, and you are in very good hands with Cindy as your transition coach. So the search is beginning in earnest, as of right now, so that's very exciting. Our reading this morning comes from Victoria Safford, my colleague Victoria Safford's meditation manual. It's a piece called Walking Towards Morning. You know, we do it every day. Every morning we go out blinking into the glare of our freedom, into the wilderness of work and the world, making maps as we go, looking for signs that we're on the right path. And on some good days, we walk right out of our oppressions, those things that press us down from the outside or as often from the inside. We shake off the shackles of fear, prejudice, timidity, closed-mindedness, selfishness, self-righteousness, and claim our freedom outright. Terrifying as it is, our freedom to be human and humane. Every morning, every day, we leave our houses not knowing if it will be for the last time, and we decide what we'll take with us, what we'll carry, how much integrity, how much truth-telling, how much compassion, in case somebody along the way may need some, how much arrogance, how much anger, how much humor, how much willingness to change and to be changed, to grow and to be grown. How much faith and hope, how much love and gratitude. You pack these things with your lunch and medications, your date book, and your papers. Every day, we gather what we think we'll need, pick up what we love, and all we so far believe, put on our history, shoulder our experience and memory, take inventory of our blessings, and we start walking towards morning. Here ends the reading. So we carry a lot with us into our day, every day. Every morning, we decide what we'll take with us, what we'll carry as we start walking towards morning. We are free, free agents, free to choose who we want to be in this world. This isn't to say that we can control what happens. There are so much in this world that is bigger than we are, but we certainly have the freedom to choose how we'll respond to the cards we're dealt. Sometimes we don't even realize the choices we make and the effect that they have until someone close to us points them out. In his book, Hunting for Hope, Scott Russell Sanders writes about an unintentional impact his despair had on his own son. The conversation goes something like this. You wouldn't understand, the son responds to his father's prodding about what was bugging him. Egged on, the son finally spills, you're just so out of touch. With what? The father asks. With my whole world. You hate everything that's fun. You hate television and movies and video games. You hate my music. Well, I do like some of your music, the father retorts. I just don't like it loud. You hate advertising, the son continues. Now he was on a roll. You hate billboards and lotteries and developers and logging companies and big corporations. You hate snowmobiles and jet skis. You hate malls and fashion and cars. Why? Because I won't buy you a Jeep, the father retorts. Forget Jeeps. You look at any car and all you think of is pollution, traffic, roadside crap. You say fast food's poisoning our bodies and TV's poisoning our minds. You think the internet is just another scam for selling stuff. You think business is a conspiracy to rape the earth. None of that bothers you? Asked the father. Of course it does, but that's the world. That's where we've got to live. It's not going away just because you don't approve. Your view of things is totally dark, Dad. It bums me out. You make me feel the planet's dying and people are to blame and there's nothing that can be done about it. There's no room for hope. Maybe you can get there without hope, by without hope, but I can't. I've still got a lot of living to do. I have to believe there's a way we can get out of this mess. Otherwise, what's the point? Why study? Why work? Why do anything if it's all going to hell? Does it sound like any conversation you've ever had with a young person? Or any conversation you've had with an older person, if you're a young person? Or when you were a young person? It's all generational, right? We are bombarded daily with what's wrong with the world. The degradation of the planet, greed, exploitation, and violence. There are so many ways we deny our interconnectedness, acting selfishly with little regard for other people, other beings. Anyone who's paying attention can't help but see that there's a lot that's not working, most of which we as individuals really can't fix. So where does that leave us? It leaves people like Scott Russell Sanders ranting about the state of the world, shaking an angry fist at everything that is so very wrong. Feeling like we can't fix things, like there's no way we can turn the tide or repair the damage, leaves some of us feeling so helpless, so powerless, that there's nothing left to do but throw up our hands in despair. What Scott Russell Sanders' son is saying to his father is that despair is not an option for him. Despair is not an option. He has to find a different way, a different way of looking at the world as it is. He has to look at what's right, what's working in his world. He has to make room for hope. And so he decides that he'll take an appreciation of what's good in his world with him as he walks into his own future. The freedom to decide. Renewing that sense of hope every day as we walk into morning. That is intention. That's setting an intention for your day. A lens, a frame, through which you can see a path which you can walk on. It's more than some Pollyannic rose-colored glasses approach to life. It's about seeing what is, looking it square in the face, and it's a both and, choosing to focus on what's possible rather than what's wrong. What's possible rather than what's wrong. The rabbi in our story this morning, he's a very sneaky guy, plants the seed of possibility in the minds and hearts of the monks. Maybe he's the Messiah. Maybe it's me. No, it couldn't possibly be me. But what if it is? That seed of hope, that seed of possibility. And the monks begin to treat one another and themselves with profound appreciation and respect, creating a community grounded in mutual respect and possibility. And they begin to see possibilities in each other and in themselves. And I want you to think about the people you know that are in this room, or people that you know outside this room if you don't know a lot of people in this room. who have been the Messiah for you, the one who has been the saving grace, who's come along at a time when you just needed something, you didn't know what, and somebody came into your life and was there for you. We are all the chosen ones. We all have the capacity to be the Messiah for one another. It's a matter of how we frame the lens that we use to look at one another and how we see one another as we walk through the world that creates that sense of possibility. That was the gift, right? That was the gift of intention. It's simply saying, wow, I see you in a new way. I'm going to see you in a different way. That's intention. We decide what we'll take with us. We decide how we'll see the world. We decide what we'll carry. We can choose cynicism and despair, or we can choose respect and hope found in the power of positive intention. It's up to us every morning, every moment. I'm going to be leading a book discussion on Francis Moore Lapp and Adam Eichen's book, Daring Democracy, this week, so I don't want to get too much into the content there. But one of the first things they talk about is the importance of the lenses through which we look at things like democracy, our own government, the way that we're organized, assumptions or frames that shape our behavior, that shape our policies. It's true for individuals, it's true for organizations, it's true for communities, and it's true for governments and countries. It's true for the world. And they use a highly charged issue, the issue of immigration, as an example. In Canada, you know, I was there for 2 years before I came back to New England. Immigration is this amazing opportunity. People are just really excited about adopting Syrian families and taking care of people from places that need taking care of. In America, though, we've been encouraged to see immigration as a threat. We may not personally feel that way, but that's the image that we are shown over and over and over again. That's the frame. And the result is tangible. It's real. The U.S. has admitted 1/3 of the number of Syrian refugees as Canada, and we have 10 times more people than they do. Frames have real power in shaping our lives at the micro level and at the macro level. Coming right back down to the personal level, the medical profession is beginning to tell us that a positive outlook can actually enhance our health. This idea has been around for a while. But a series of studies show that gratitude promotes physical and emotional well-being, improves our ability to cope with stress, and bolsters positive interaction with others. Research shows grateful individuals report having more energy and less physical complaints than their non-grateful counterparts. Positive emotion enhance heart health by interrupting the stress response caused by negative emotions. In short, the practice of gratitude offers a method for a more harmonious life. It's real. It's tangible. Looking at what's right, what's working, what's good is good for people, and it's also good for organizations, for communities, for congregations. Professor Suresh Srivastava and his doctoral student, David Cooper-Ryder, discovered that how good it was for organizations when they studied the Cleveland Clinic, a cutting-edge program known for the high morale among its staff. Cooper-Ryder was supposed to discover what made the place tick so he could make recommendations for improving it. What he discovered was it wasn't broken. There was nothing to fix. Just like we're not broken. None of us are broken. We're not problems to be solved. There's nothing to fix. When he suggested to Professor Shivastra that he study another more broken organization, Professor Shivastra sent him back to the Cleveland Clinic to ask why it was functioning so well. Now that was pretty smart. And so began a new way of looking at organizational development called appreciative inquiry. Looking at what's working in an organization and building on its strengths rather than assuming that something's broken that needs to be fixed. Now, those of you who have worked in organizations know that when you are doing planning, you usually start with what? A problem that needs solving, right? You usually start at the top with the thing you want to fix, and then you figure out how you're going to fix it, right? Well, that's sort of the opposite of what appreciative inquiry does. Here are some of the basic assumptions. In every organization, there are some things that are working well. What we focus on becomes our reality. So if you focus on what's going well, you're going to become well. You're going to become healthier and more whole. That asking questions influences the group. Asking positive questions influences the group positively. And people have more confidence in the journey to the future when they can carry forward parts of the past. So if we've had the experience of something working well, we can bring that experience into what we're trying to build for the future. Appreciative inquiry is a process that we can use here to help identify, I love this language, the life-giving forces that already exist in this congregation. You all can think of times when you felt more alive, more vibrant, more connected to one another, more connected to spirit, more connected to the world in terms of justice issues. We've all had that feeling of sort of being enhanced, like you get a shot in the arm when you see people that you know love you and care for you, or when you're engaged in meaningful work that you know is going to help other people. These are the things that are both tangible and intangible that make us who we are. They are, to paraphrase Victoria Safford, what we can gather from, what we think we'll need, what we love and all that we so far believe, our history, our experience and memory, an inventory of our blessings that we can carry with us as we move into our future together. This seems particularly timely that Cindy's here as we're talking about this moving into the future together part, because there's this wonderful opportunity for you, for us all to talk together about this life-giving force that's here in this congregation and to make it articulate it and make it more explicit so it can be your prize, you know, eyes on the prize. That can be your direction. The best of who you've been can be the best of who you want to be going forward. The benefits of looking at this church community through a positive lens is much the same as it is for individual. Focus on what's going well enhances a sense of physical and emotional well-being. And you will find as you go through the search that you're going to be really excited. There's going to be a lot of energy created by this whole process. And it's a great time to garner that energy and do something with it. To have important conversations about who you want to be together. It's a great time to have those conversations. And so, on February 4th, after worship, the transition team and I are inviting you to share a soup lunch. We had a very nice soup lunch when we did our history exercise, something similar to that. And then to hang out and share stories about this church at its best. Moments when you felt most alive, most engaged, most connected. Moments when you felt deeply moved, deeply loved in this church community. There's a lot of good news in those stories. Information about the best this church has to offer, and you want to be together as you look towards that future. How wonderful is that? Your stories are a catalyst that can propel you into those possibilities. So I've just given you a little background on the process, and hopefully it will pique your interest, and you'll want to come and be thinking of your story. And come share those stories with us on the 4th. Hopefully, some of the insight into the importance of looking at our lives through this lens of appreciation, both in your personal life, though, you know, and take some of this home with you, too, and in our lives together, I've come to believe that we can learn a lot about who we want to be by focusing on the best of who we've been, the life-giving forces in our lives, and how we can share those life-giving forces with others. It's a process of listening to where you've been that can tell you something about where you want to go. You may have noticed the Wayside Pulpit has a quote from Parker Palmer on one side this month. He says, "Before you tell your life what you intend to do with it, listen to what it intends to do with you." Right? And so sharing these stories is a way of lifting some of that up. It's kind of like when you start talking, you don't know what you're going to say, and you start to say something, and you're like, oh, yeah, that is it. So you may hear something in your own story in somebody else's story that actually tells you something you didn't know about what's important to you about being a part of this community. My hopes are that by sharing stories about what you found here, meaning, spirit, connection, all the things that are right and good about being together, that you'll realize that you can choose where you want to go together. In just a few minutes, we'll sing together, "We are going, heaven knows where we are going, but we'll know within." Trust that place within yourselves to know we will get there. Heaven knows how we will get there, but we know we will. May it be so. Blessed be, and amen. So I invite you to stand in body or in spirit and let's sing together, "Whoa, Ya, Ya." It's number 1020 in the teal books if you want to look at the music. Otherwise, the words are up on the slide. I invite you now to join hands for the closing words. You will realize in our time together that I love Margaret Wheatley. And you may get sick of these closing words, but I can never hear them often enough. So these are the words of Margaret Wheatley. She writes, "There is no greater power than a community discovering what it cares about. Ask what's possible, not what's wrong, and keep asking. Notice what you care about. Assume that many others share your dreams. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Talk to people who know. Talk to people you don't know. Talk to people you never talk to. Very important. Be intrigued by the differences you hear. Expect to be surprised. Treasure curiosity more than certainty. Invite in everybody who cares to work on what's possible Acknowledge that everyone is an expert about something. Know that creative solutions come from new connections. Remember, you don't fear people whose story you know. Real listening always brings people closer together. Trust that meaningful conversations can change your world. Rely on human goodness, and for heaven's sake, stay together. Blessed be.